Welcome to the Breakout Growth Podcast, where Sean Ellis and Ethan Garr interview leaders from the world's fastest growing companies to get to the heart of what's really driving their growth. And now, here are your hosts, Sean Ellis and Ethan Garr.
In this week's episode of the Breakout Growth Podcast, Ethan Garr and I interview Kieran Flanagan, HubSpot's Senior Vice President of Marketing. With more than 100,000 customers and now over $1 billion in ARR, HubSpot's breakout growth success is nothing short of meteoric. I'm sure most of our listeners are very familiar with HubSpot, which is now the number one CRM platform for scaling businesses. So Ethan, what stood out for you from this conversation?
It's hard to even know where to begin, Sean. What stood out most to me is just how relatable Kieran made this conversation for businesses large and small. At HubSpot's scale, he explained that they can no longer rely on incremental experiments. That just won't move the needle when you're a $37 billion entity like they are. Yet he was able to provide a framework for decision-making that I think anyone in our audience can appreciate.
Yeah, the fact that he's been with HubSpot for nearly 10 years and that he's been a part of their many evolutions that have included the move to freemium and the move from inbound marketing to what he describes as inbound media really gives him great perspective. And he's just generally a really good guy to chat about growth with.
Yeah, he just seems like a really nice guy. And by the way, did you catch his comment that he believes that community is the future for HubSpot?
I did. And considering we just spoke with Mark Tan at Wise about community-led growth in our last episode, it's clear that this is a theme that is taking hold throughout the growth community.
It sure is. Companies that embrace their communities are destined to win. Well, Sean, we actually have some big news. Do you think it's time to share it?
It is. So before we jump in with our guests, we are thrilled to welcome our first sponsor of the Breakout Growth Podcast. This week's episode is brought to you by Rise with SAP S/4HANA Cloud. Hypergrowth companies get up and running quickly with this low-cost, easy-to-implement cloud ERP solution. If you are working to power breakout growth success in your business, please check out sap.com/highgrowth.
That's right. We are super excited to be partnering with SAP, just an amazing company. And thanks to all of you, our listeners, the Breakout Growth Podcast has grown into one of the most trusted podcasts in our space. If you have a moment, please tap the subscribe button wherever you listen. And if you can, please also let your friends in growth know about the podcast. Hey, Sean, should we jump in with Kieran?
All right, let's do it. Hi, Kieran. Welcome to the Breakout Growth Podcast.
Hey, Sean. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be on.
Yeah, we're definitely excited to have you on. HubSpot is a company we've both followed for a really long time and excited to share more details of the story for a lot of our listeners. Also joined by my co-host, Ethan Garr. Welcome, Ethan.
Hey, Sean, and thanks for coming here, Kieran. We're really excited to speak with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as I mentioned, probably a lot of our listeners are very familiar with HubSpot, but in case someone's been living under a rock for the last 5 years, how would you generally describe it?
Yeah, I'll give you the brand line. What the brand team would be very happy, which is the number one CRM for scaling companies. It's really front office for companies who want to grow, be differentiated. We give tools across marketing, sales, customer success, ops, operations, and a kind of modern day CRM built for the internet.
Yeah. And so you've been there a pretty long time. And I know in the early days when people asked me about HubSpot, I couldn't describe it at all. It's obviously moved more in that direction of CRM. Have you found that it becomes easier to describe what HubSpot is in recent years versus the early years?
You know, I feel like HubSpot, you used to describe it as a methodology because the methodology was better than the product. And I'm sure the product team wouldn't mind me saying that back in when we really just had a point solution for helping you do kind of inbound marketing and blogging and SEO. I think, and the other interesting thing is all your if you're a category creation and you have a methodology, if you win in that space, then anything transformational just becomes best practice, right? So inbound marketing isn't that differentiated. And for us, what differentiates us today is really that product. So the inbound methodology still is how we really run the entire business. We call it the flywheel now. But I think the product is just so much more robust, so much more better that, describing it as like a CRM, people kind of know what that is. It does mean that you're in a kind of space where it's harder to be differentiated, or it was easier to be differentiated in inbound than that. But I still think the way we do that is because the product is just so good.
Yeah, as Sean said, I think when I read, you've been at the company for, I think, more than 10 years now, and you've had a bunch of different roles, but from marketing and growth. How's the company for you changed over that time? And like, what's kept you excited and really interested?
Yeah. Before I joined HubSpot, I think the longest I was at the company was 18 months. And I used to always look at people who are in companies 10 years and like, wow, how do you stay in a company for 10 years? That's wild. And then this year, particularly because it actually is, I'm in 9 years, but I'll be 10 years at the end. I think of 10 years in January. But this has been the year where everyone's like, wow, yeah, you've been in the company for a long time. I'm like, oh my God, like I'm one of those people where everyone goes, you've been in the company a long time. So why am I still here? I think I've been really fortunate that my kind of mission has changed every kind of two to two and a half years. And because the HubSpot has grown so rapidly when I joined, I think it was 300 to 400 employees. And now it's at 10 times the size. And so I joined to grow up the international business. I was very fortunate. There's not like huge opportunities to do these kind of roles when you're based in Dublin. You usually have to be in a really great city in the States. And so I joined to grow up the international business. That went really well. And then they kind of came to me, the founders and JD, who was the COO at the time, and said, hey, we're going to pivot the business to be more kind of product led. And do you want to take on the market and the growth side of things? And I moved to Boston, and I couldn't move to Boston, and they let me do it from Dublin to try to do it remotely. And this was back in the days when my first conversation with my new team that I took on was to like go to meeting and I couldn't see anyone, and the audio was terrible, and working remotely was really horrible. And then I did that for 2.5 years. I went then to fix all of our kind of take over all the customer acquisition teams and rebuild how we did acquisition, because that's a big part of how HubSpot grows. And then today I have a kind of different mission. I still have those ones, but we bought a media company this year, The Hustle, a really great company, and kind of working with that team and others to build out a true like media org within HubSpot. And that's something that we have. We've always had a big belief around, but we're trying to be more ambitious around.
Yeah. And that sounds like kind of the inbound marketing idea is all about like content, or a large part of it, about kind of onboarding people through value add. And so it makes sense that you guys would buy a media company.
Yeah, inbound media. That's the thing that I have transitioned. It's inbound marketing to inbound media. So that's the next thing that I'm excited about.
Very cool. You know, so I actually got into HubSpot kind of accidentally, because I was an advisor to David Cancel's Performable It got acquired by HubSpot. Yeah, so I was... I knew Dharmesh already at that point, so founder Dharmesh, but it was kind of neat to sort of stumble into the back door and get into the like kind of pre-IPO HubSpot and follow it along. But yeah, I mean, I think even for a lot of that time, it was still pretty hard for me to explain. But I think I finally got my head around it.
So. Yeah. The number one CRM for scaling companies, I think that one is the one that rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, absolutely. So in your, you know, as you mentioned, you've kind of gone through different roles while you've been there, and different opportunities have emerged and probably challenges in your SVP marketing role. So how do you view that in the context of growth? What impact do you make on growth and your teams versus, you know, who else in the organization is focused on growth?
Yeah, so HubSpot is a really large company now. So growth is really, like, we have a flywheel org that really owns all the go-to-market motion. The flywheel org is all marketing, sales, customer success, and product outside of that. And then there's a product growth team that own all the kind of product-led metrics within the app. And so I can talk about it as well, what it was like in the early days, trying to like build out that first product-led motion. But how I kind of drive growth for the business today is one of the things that's unique about HubSpot. So we reached $1 billion in AR this year. The kind of unique thing about HubSpot, which is why I still love being there as a marketer, is most of our revenue comes from demand sourced by the marketing team, right? So the marketing are on the hook for revenue, and you have to do pretty large scale thinking to get to that size in revenue from a marketing source demand. And so I have a group that drive all of the demand, whether that's the leads or the users or all the different things, where we turn those into customers. Building out this media org. The media org, we really believe, is how do we be an ever-present part of our customers' life long before they even become a customer of our product. And so if you think about it, when we built out inbound marketing, it was really on the premise that the internet kind of blew up and everyone became, and it kind of how-to content became democratized, right? We went online to try to solve our own problems. And that meant that B2B companies could build out these content programs and be present when people had problems, right? They could be a trusted source of content when those people were online searching for problems. The cool thing about building media is you can become a trusted source of information all the time, right? People aren't just living on blogs. People aren't just using the internet to search for things. They're like in podcasts. They're in newsletters. They're in all these different mediums. And so I think about that transition from inbound marketing to inbound media as being, oh, I used to be present and a trusted source of information when you had a problem, and now I'm part of your daily consumption habits. And content consumption, digital content consumption, actually grew by 4x during 2020. Like, it's just part and parcel of how really how we're kind of starting to live our lives on the internet. And then I have another group, and I'm really excited about this. It's our academy, our credentials, our community. I think community is really at the core of HubSpot's future. And then we've just launched this network, HubSpot Network. It's at the very early minimal viable stage. If you go to network.hubspot.com, you can go claim your profile, go do that. And that's really all around how we drive customer success, because we just have a lot of customers. I can pause there. Happy to go back to like what it was like when we first start to try to back into product-led and try to build out that growth function.
Yeah, I think that'd be great.
Yeah.
Yeah, so HubSpot is like you've probably seen this a lot, Sean. You've probably seen companies who have been product-led first. Like, HubSpot was actually kind of interesting because we were not product-led first, right? We were a company that generated a bunch of leads, turned those into QLs, customers. And so we backed into product-led. And one of the things that was really, I went into that was like, I remember drawing up my first map and I was like, oh, well, the product-led stuff is much, it's the same kind of funnel, right? You just generate users, you turn them into PQLs instead of MQLs, and then you generate revenue. And like, it's not the same at all. It's very, very different. And the way teams work together is very different. And the way teams need to be designed is very different. So really that first year for us was, we had a kind of marketing. I own the users, PQL, some of the touches revenue with a product team.
Can you explain what PQL is for anyone who
product qualified leads. So basically PQL for us was when you could go into the app and some of the features were gated, some of them were triggered based on usage. So you could have a certain amount of usage and then it would trigger this modal within the app and say, hey, reach out to the sales team or upgrade TouchC to do that. And so for us, then we just call all of that hand raisers, like that you've showed some intent, you've taken an action to show that you want to talk about buying this product. We had another thing that we used to do, which was kind of, I can't remember the acronym we used, kind of like a PQL, where you would do all the actions within the product that would suggest you were a good fit, but you wouldn't click on the modal and want to reach out to the sales team, but we would still test to rotate those to the sales. And yeah, I think in that, so in the early days, we probably changed the team structure several times in that first year. That was really one of the things that was most surprising to me is when you're in a marketing sales-led business, you have like marketing and sales working together in the go-to-market motion. When you're at a product-led, you have marketing, sales, product, engineer, and customer success. You have much more teams working in that go-to-market motion. And that those lines of like who owns what became a lot more blurry. It took us a long time to like figure that part out.
That's interesting. It just real quick on the, just follow up on that very last part. When the lines blur on who owns what, like that's also a sign of something that's potentially good. It's kind of like you're maybe becoming less siloed. How do you balance between those to where you know it's like, okay, it's a good thing because it's becoming less siloed, and it's maybe a challenge because that clear ownership isn't there?
I went to this kind of like, I wouldn't call it self-help, but I used to be in this thing called Neuro-Linguistic Program. It's like this kind of cult, but it kind of, how do you I'm going somewhere with this. How do you like reframe the way you think about problems? But there is a cult aspect to it, which I did not know until I went to the first conference, and that's a whole other story. But one of the lines they use, which I really love, is like, before your biggest breakthroughs, you're at your biggest point of confusion. You're at your most confused, right? You're at your most confused. You should embrace that because you're actually about to have your biggest breakthrough.
Yeah, you're letting go of your clarity.
Yeah. And that's, so to your point, like that's kind of what you said. When you're in it, it doesn't feel like that. It just feels like everyone's fighting with each other. But you are starting to have these moments of clarity where like, oh, well, actually, the way we should do this is we should have a pod around this metric. Like, it's not like this kind of T-structure silo, marketing own this, and then we hand across the sales, and then they own that, and product own this. You can actually create these cross-functional pods to own metrics and just ensure that you have the correct skills within those pods. And I think that was one of the things that, one of our big breakthroughs is we just work far better with product. Now we're able to like figure out how we tackle large problems together, and you have much more teams working more in a collaborative fashion. And the other thing that's super interesting is everyone starts to talk about the business in the same way, right? It starts to bring uniformity of language across the business. And so when everyone is kind of involved in the core go-to-market motion, and there's clarity of these teams working together on these different metrics, you start to speak the same language of growth. And I think that is actually something you wouldn't expect to have a huge impact on your success, but it really does.
Actually, I really want to ask you about the cult, because that sounds fascinating, but we probably shouldn't skip that for right now. Following up on that, you're really talking about sort of how you manage extremely large teams and how that works well. And the pod structure is something I've been part of and also heard a lot of in the really emerging in the last few years as being a key way that companies are able to successfully lead across large organizations collaboratively. I'm curious, Sean and I are always talking about companies' North Star metrics. And I know that HubSpot's North Star metric, at least it used to be weekly active teams. And I'm wondering, A, is that still current? And B, is that an important piece of managing that collaborative structure?
So when we first launched, it was weekly active teams. When we launched the product-led business, the free business, we were a separate business from the core business. We were almost like a startup. And so we had no users, we had nothing, we had a smaller budget. And so we were really obsessed about how do we drive weekly active users and then PQLs. But that weekly active user was our North Star metric. HubSpot is just such a much more complex business now. When we merge the product-led business to the core business, we have two different kind of go-to-markets where you can become a lead, you can become a user. When you become a user, there's just so much more metrics to actually look at. So that the product growth team still do look at weekly active teams. I think there's a multitude of North Star metrics that we look at versus a singular one. But that was the thing that we obsessed over in the first 2 years.
Kind of a North Star galaxy or something.
Yeah. It's a North Star in North Star universe. You want to see one of the data dashboards that I look at now? It's like the matrix of this metrics coming down from beyond.
Yeah. So it's interesting as you touch on kind of the evolution and going to product led and then kind of evolving to where product led is maybe just a component. I know for me, there was a snapshot along the way where as I mentioned, I was confused by HubSpot for a long time. And then one day, I tell you, I had stock through the IPO, sold the stock and, did well with it, as you do usually when you have pre-IPO stock. But then one day I was looking at HubSpot and I literally said, oh my God, I see how this is coming together. This is amazing, particularly when I saw how you had really moved to almost everything that you were doing. There was a free component of it, not just a watered down, crappy free component, but actually a really good free CRM that was not just we're gonna do a light version of Salesforce and give it away for free, but it was actually better in a lot of ways because it was automated as you have contacts and email, it's writing in and building out contacts and building out history. And I remember I saw that and I said, oh my God, I think this is amazing. And so went and made my biggest public market stock purchase in a long time. And
oh, nice.
I sent a note to Dharmesh I looked it up yesterday. That was November 2017. And I sent a note and I was like, Dharmesh, I just got really excited about what you guys are doing. Just bought some stock again. And we're about 1,000% up since.
You're happy this week then with the payments announcement. Yeah. Really, the market loved that announcement.
Yeah, I wish I could say that I've held all the way through, but I wrote it up quite a bit. Yeah. and got to the point where it couldn't possibly go up from here. Yeah.
I don't think anyone could hold. I think anyone could hold for that long.
Yeah, but probably more important thing to me was sort of saying, okay, this seems to be an interesting transition point in the business that it went into a kind of hyper growth mode. And so I'm curious from your perspective, how important was freemium in driving a lot of that stock appreciation or what you were doing with freemium, or is that just one of the many components of what's been important in the success of HubSpot?
So I think it was one of them for sure. I think there's some pivotal moments in a company. If you think about the companies who make it to $1 billion in revenue, it's kind of rarefied air. It's not it's not common. I think what I've from being in that journey for some while, from some time now, there's like a couple of bets. If you get them right, then you just are able to get outweighted leverage on them. The freemium bet to us is not too dissimilar from like the inbound bet, because it's all mapped to changes in the way that people want to buy products. And so if you think about inbound marketing, it was really kind of bottoms up content. It was like, okay, well, you don't need to just get the decision maker on board. If you actually consume, if you actually build a brand around all these people who will eventually use the product, they'll have outweighed impact on getting you people to buy the product within the company, right? Just bottoms up company instead of going after decision makers. And that's why back, you know, some years ago, most B2B brands didn't really have like large audiences, because they just marketed content to decision makers, way less decision makers than there are people who use the product. Freemium is somewhat the natural evolution of that, right? Now we acquire all the people through content that can use our product. They love your brand. They're getting an education, but they can't do anything because you have to still go to the person in your company and say, please, can we use this? Give us budget. Well, if you have a free product, now you can start to monetize all the people onto the product and do the land and expand. And I think people over time just don't want to talk to other people. They want to be able to come in, have a frictionless experience, be able to buy the product, be able to get value from it before they ever decide to upgrade and buy more product. And I think that's the thing the founders of HubSpot, I think that what they're really good at is trying to obsess over how customers want to buy products in the future and how they want to use products in the future. And that was the bet, is like, hey, we think the way that people are going to want to consume software and buy software, I'm a lot more like B2C than it does B2B.
Yeah. It's interesting because I look at freemium as actually pretty similar to content marketing, in the sense that content is actually kind of a pain in the ass to keep creating. It's not to say that it's like, you know, some people really enjoy it. Like we're creating content right now. I enjoy this process, but it's time consuming. And I think what's interesting about freemium is that you essentially, you know, software is content in a sense. It's you're creating IP and you're creating experiences that are building that trust and that foundation, much in the same way that content does, but it's just a little bit more scalable. It's in something where the person in engaging with it, or multiple people engaging with it, are getting value, and they can kind of continue to create their own value, as opposed to a big content machine that needs to keep feeding them content. So right. Anyway, it's interesting how it
yeah
how it comes
and together. And then you see and now you see B2B companies who look a lot more like B2C companies in terms of their scale. Like Loom has 12 million users. Calendly has something like 3 to 5 million users. Like you just see these kind of B2B companies who have like real kind of B2C scale. And I think the interesting thing around that is like, it helps you to attract talent from the B2C world. So actually B2B marketing, B2B growth get a lot better. It starts to make B2B much more exciting. Like I think it makes it like a lot more exciting to be in.
Yeah, I was actually on the board of directors of a company that started in not B2C, but like really, really low average price B2B with a freemium offering. And they just kept getting pulled up market until there were like multi-million dollar deals coming in. And I was on the board for 5 years, and I have to tell you that when they got, you know, eventually I was just like, oh my gosh, I do not like enterprise. Yeah. It's just like, it's just a slog. You're hiring salespeople. It takes a long time for them to get up to speed. You got churn of salespeople that you need to start worrying about, where you just have a much more sort of scalable engine when it's being fed from a kind of product led approach to it. So
yeah, I want to actually follow up on that, because one thing that seems like HubSpot's been really disciplined in targeting and staying focused on that small and medium, you know, SMBs, that market, and not really pushing to go up market. Is that something that, you know, there's been a lot of pressure for you and your teams to do, or is it something that just it's natural, like this flywheel works, we're going to keep?
So I would say we have gone up market, but probably not as overtly as you see other SaaS brands. What happened to HubSpot, and probably happens to a lot of companies, is if you do what you say your product will do, you're going to have a natural pull to go up market, or all your customers who are successful in your platform will churn, because you have customers in your platform and their needs become more sophisticated because now you're making them more successful. And so you naturally do get dragged up market. I think the question is, can you get dragged up market without losing your contact with SMB and mid-market? And to Sean's point earlier, what we're doing is pushing an incredible amount of value down into free, right? Because we don't want to just go up market and say, well, we're not interested in the SMB and the mid-market space. We want to have like the full breadth of companies who can start on our platform when you're a 1 to 5 person team and get a lot of value from free, and then grow all the way to your 1,000 person team. We're a 4,000 person team or whatever the number is, and we use HubSpot, right? And so we want to be able to grow with you. And as you become successful and your customers should become more successful by investing in you, then you naturally start to have to build for more sophisticated needs.
This week's Breakout Growth Podcast episode is sponsored by SAP. SAP helps businesses increase productivity and achieve real-time transparency with the power and flexibility of RISE with SAP S/4HANA Cloud. If you have ambitious goals and are working to lead markets and industries, then you probably already know how important it is to align with a technology partner who will scale and drive innovation with your business. With Grow by SAP, future industry leaders like yourself don't have to rely on stitched-together solutions that don't talk to each other to manage business finances, operations, and customer relations. Instead, leveraging the flexibility of SAP's cloud-based solution, you can power all these in one place and gain unprecedented insights into the performance of your business from end to end. Whether you're on the brink of or have already achieved breakout growth success, learn more by visiting sap.com/highgrowth.
You will lose your customers if you don't adapt to their growing needs over time. It's interesting how focusing on, I don't think using B2C tactics necessarily pulls you away from that over time. I think you have to get good at using both. It's funny because a while back now, Sean and I co-wrote an article called The New B2B Growth Playbook. And one of the things we realized about the fastest growing B2B companies is that they were all borrowing concepts from the world of B2C, but they weren't doing it at the expense of, you know, building those higher end relationships.
Yeah. B2C to B.
So yeah, clearly most of what we've covered up to this point has been the incredible success story of HubSpot. And I'm sure we could position everything as it's just been like sunshine and flowers all the way through. But I know you don't get to that success without challenges along the way. And so I think particularly for listeners that, you know, when they run into those challenges, for me, I tell my kids this, they're both in college now. And I'm like, the difference between successful people and unsuccessful people is that successful people come up against challenges all the time that are super legitimate excuses for failure. Like everyone will say, oh, of course you couldn't have succeeded. You hit that. But the successful people say, I'm going to succeed anyway. And they find a way to work around those challenges and succeed anyway. So looking at companies, I think there's something to that on a company level as well. And so as you look back over your time at HubSpot, has there been a time where you felt stuck, where you felt like you were up against a challenge that seemed almost insurmountable? And if yes, how did you overcome that challenge?
There's actually three that come to mind. The first was actually when we started to build that product-led motion. Like I actually didn't really know how I was going to succeed, as in acquiring for users was somewhat new to me. CRM is pretty saturated market. I actually came from Salesforce, so I know that market. I went and I told you about the team design. Like the team design was all quite new in terms of how you did that. That one specifically, I think that one I spent so much time talking to others. Like I've always thought it's this really simple cheat sheet of how you get better is like go talk to people who are better than you. I just don't know why more people don't like lead into that. It's actually the only reason I started my podcast is to get a reason to go talk to people and actually learn from them. And so that's one. Now, the second thing that's a little bit more practical, and I use this for this problem and I used it for another problem when we actually, again, coming back to something I said earlier, the business is quite dependent upon the fact that we don't want to continue to grow our acquisition and we get more people coming in through education and stuff and things like that. And we have had periods when you get to our scale, there are periods of stagnation, like, oh my God, is this as big as a B2B company can go in terms of the amount of demand that we acquire? Maybe there's just no way to break through those walls. The thing that we always start with is, and it's like, it's pretty foundational to growth is, okay, like where in 12 months are we trying to get to? And then based upon that, we start to reverse engineer back through the kind of core metrics. The reason we do that is because then you start to whittle away at like, actually, hardly any of these things can scale to the level we need them to scale. And so there's no point us spending time on these small things when they just don't add up to enough value. Like we're at a certain point where we have to make large bets because the small bets just won't add up to something that's significant to us. Reverse engineer into the things and then trying to prioritize things and trying to do minimal viable versions of them. The one thing I have learned, you can minimal viable version your way to iterate, like especially in the acquisition part of things, like minimal viable version your way to like very small marginal gains. We're in a place where we can take big bets because we have resources. Like sometimes you have to take risky bets that you can't size up accurately through that model, like that you have to be prepared to be really wrong, right? And I think that is a hard thing to do, but when you get to a certain size, you have to be prepared to risk falling flat on your face in a bigger style, like because the minimal viable version of what you want to do is such of a high quality, like you can't really minimal viable version it, that you just have to do it to see if it will work or not. And so we've done some of that where they failed and they haven't failed and they've worked pretty well. Team structure, I talked about it free, but just in terms of like frameworks and processes, so let me give you a good example. We were a certain size with all of our blogs. Like we were a blogs drive a lot of our growth. I think we were at like 3 to 5 million monthly visits. And we were like, oh, well, this is, everything is stagnating. Now that's probably as big as you can. We went back over and we really built out this. And I give all the credit to my search team and the blogging team, the content team. They built out these amazing frameworks for how they like scientifically build editorial calendars to ensure that we can cover off every single piece of content that's relevant to our audience that has search traffic. So they reverse engineered into the problem and then looked at the solutions to that, which is like, okay, well, could we be more methodical about how we actually build editorial calendars? And now in each editorial calendar we build up each quarter, we size up the amount of available traffic that we can go after. So we have like, oh, the Q2 editorial calendar is worth 2 million available searches in that calendar. We can get a percentage of that. Like I can basically tell you the playbooks because they're branded and they have like actual playbooks that are on our wiki that have been instrumental into our success. So if I was giving people advice, I would say, try to start where you want to be. Like what is the endpoint? And then you try and reverse engineer into your most important metrics. Look at the things that actually will add up to the success you need, right? And try to get rid of all the rest. Try to really define the playbook around the thing that you want to try. Bucket them into, here are some that I'm going to do minimal viable versions of. Here are some I'm just going to take big bets on. If they fail, they fail. And then sweat the details. Like HubSpot we're not successful on the acquisition side because we figured anything out that anyone else hasn't, right? How do you grow a big business on marketing? Search, paid, product virality, word of mouth. There's not like hidden sources out there, but we do them to assert, we sweat the details, right? Every single thing that you can optimize and improve upon, we do that. And I think that's one of the reasons we've been successful.
Yeah. So it's interesting as you were going through the different challenges, the challenge of size is definitely one that I've experienced myself. I remember at LogMeIn when we got to around $50 million in revenue and then because we were really leaning hard into freemium, we had about 100 million devices with our software on there. Yeah, trying to come up with new channels that fail that is really hard. And there's probably a lot of listeners that think, oh, champagne problem. Like, you know, they probably need to go and read the Paul Graham Do Things That Don't Scale that are just all about the hustle and grind. But it was interesting because I did take that experience at LogMeIn to Dropbox, and yeah, there was enough elements at Dropbox early on that I could essentially say, okay, if we build a marketing engine that's dependent on marketing spend, it gets really hard to scale that long term because the channels that can move the needle eventually really shrink down. And so let's really try to build a customer get customer kind of referral driven growth engine, because one, it's already happening really well in Dropbox, and two, there's some just natural product advantages with, you know, people sharing files and collaborative folders and some other pieces. And it was interesting because the growth at Dropbox was so much more consistent and linear all the way through $1 billion revenue run rate, that when you're kind of building that engine based on the bigger your user base gets, the more powerful your growth engine gets. If you kind of set it up.
Yeah, it's compounding.
Yeah, but it was really interesting to have that conversation with Drew, the CEO, the week of the public launch. So, you know, to be thinking that far and but yeah, I mean, there's obviously a ton of other factors that went in to continue to have growth to that level. But it is, I really like you honing in on that challenge, that being huge is not a always an advantage when it comes to marketing. It becomes really hard to find things.
Yeah, because the things you have to do are outside of that. I was having this conversation with Kip, our CMO, recently. The things you have to do are just unnatural too. What I mean by that is, like, there's no playbook for them. You're doing something like, oh, like, this is actually okay. We don't know how this is going to go because there's no historical context. You can't look and go, well, it's work here, here, here. You're just like, oh, I think this is work. Like, we're optimistic about this, but you're kind of having to define it as you go along. It definitely forces you to stretch. It forces you to be an eternal optimist, and it forces you to really stretch how you think about things.
I think in growth, it's a constant question of, like, do we take incremental bets or big bets? What should we be doing? And I think you're making the point at scale, it becomes less of a conversation because you kind of have fewer options in that department because the incremental bets just aren't going to get you there. I'm curious, especially for our audience, as they're thinking about when to take the big bets or when to keep working incrementally. Do you have sort of your thoughts as, you know, and with your organization, how you drive that culture where we know when to take the right bets, when to take the big bets, and kind of how do you think about making sure that everybody in your organization now understands that they can make big mistakes? You know, if we make big bets, we occasionally make big mistakes, and it's okay to do that.
So I think you're a portfolio manager, right? And when you're in a smaller company, all of your portfolios are, like, I don't know the right analogy, but maybe like bonds, or like they're surefire bets, right? They have small incremental payback over a period of time, but they get you the type of growth that you need in that period of time. And then you start to, like, manage risk, right? You have maybe 80% in things that you have historical context for. Like, people really, the way I always think about things in terms of, I know there's all these different models, the potential, the impact, the ease. And I think the really important one is the historical context. Like, do you have historical context to show that this will work? Because it just makes things much more easier to do. Like, we've done this before. Someone's done this before. Like, we know there's an existing playbook that works. That historical context is really important. And so when you start to manage your portfolio, you have things that I have historical context about, I can do, I think they're going to have some amount of upside, I can kind of forecast it. And then I have some amount of my bets and things that I think that these are going to have outweighed huge returns, but I have no way to build a realistic model around. How do you build a culture of that? I think everyone who's, any people who are truly talented, the things that they really crave are a goal. How am I accountable to this goal? How are you going to track me? And I want autonomy to, like, go after this, right? In a larger company, that does start to get harder, right? Because there's just, like, lots more matrix and cross-team initiatives and reliance on other people. I think that you create a culture of allowing people to take big bets by having it in your operating model in some way. So we have a process where you can write their kind of compass stories, and you can write compass stories and seek funding from the company for large initiatives. And you have to do your due diligence. You have to shape up the problem. You have to show the data to show that's a problem. You have to show the potential impact of that problem. And then you get some resources and you can go build a minimum viable version and test that out. HubSpot was really built on experiments. Like, most of the things that have become successful has been someone trying to do things, working on things and experimenting with things. It was built into the fabric of the company. I think our problem wasn't that people were ever afraid to take big bets. I think our problem was we probably didn't have enough processes around it. And so you have people taking bets all over the places. Like you go to the website and someone's changed the homepage. You're like, who the hell changed the homepage? I think, how do you put it into your operating model so people know, okay, this is how I pitch for things. This is how they get funded. This is how they get assessed. So it doesn't feel like it's biased in any way. Like, it's assessed fairly against anyone else's ideas. This is what the company really prioritized this year. Like, these are the big bets they want people to make in these areas, and give people a forum where they know how they can actually do that.
That's really helpful. And I think you make a really good point about historical context really becoming important in the decision-making process, and you only gain that over time. Sean and I were just chatting a few days ago. I was making the point that we were working with a company, and their first set of experiments, all their math, it's so hard to guess on the math for these experiments. What's the impact going to be? How confident are we? Because there isn't this historical context. But with what we were talking about is, on the second experiment, the follow-on experiment from that, assuming that you get some sort of confirmation, the math gets easier, right? Because now you have all those learnings. So what you're saying is that after almost 10 years at HubSpot, you have all of these learnings. If you can get everybody in the organization to really see those learnings and understand what we've learned over time, those big bets become, I guess, there's less risk with those big bets because you have more of a framework for knowing what might work than you might have had a few years ago.
We have more historical context. We have so much historical context because we tried so much. That doesn't mean there's like things that it's still hard to model. Like we still build models sometimes, and I look at the model and I go, that doesn't really matter what this model says because we really have no idea. I think the model, when you have no historical context, one thing it's good at doing is just telling you, is this worth your time? Like at least telling you, well, I think it could be 10x, even though like I don't know. But like if I'm going in there and I'm doing a model with no historical context and it's like a 2x return and you can't really get yourself motivated to make it bigger because you don't feel it's going to be bigger, it just maybe allows you to like deprioritize things. You know, the thing that historical context can be, where lots of historical context can actually be, it's mostly in your favor, but where it can be problematic is where you hire like lots more people rapidly and they come in and they want to try the same things that you've done before but haven't worked. And you're like, oh, well, we've tried that before, and you shut them all down because you're like, oh, well, historical context will tell us this hasn't worked before. And so I think you have to be really careful as well about, okay, well, have they framed up the problem correctly? Have they really thought about the impact? And if this is a potential solution and they want to try again, we'll let them, because the best way people become good at their jobs is actually to fail. Like you learn way more in actually being wrong about something than you do being given something to just execute. And so you have to like find that balance where you use historical context to like direct people in the correct path, but not just shut everything down because it's been done before. Because maybe you didn't do it well before. Maybe the person who did that didn't do a great job of that before.
It's interesting. I think as you get bigger, what you had said, like people become better at their job through failing. But as you get bigger, for most organizations, there's just not a lot of incentive to fail. Every failure you make is you stick your neck out a little further to where you risk getting that paid off. Where you know the best way to be able to stay in an organization safely is to kind of go unnoticed. I do my job. Yeah. I'm trustworthy, and so I'm just curious if there's mistakes that you see leaders make that maybe shuts down some of that creative problem solving that's so critical for figuring out success and getting to where you guys have gotten.
That's a great point. You don't want to create a culture where the people who get promoted are the people who make no mistakes, right? I think you want to kind of encourage that. I think, again, it's if you put it into the operating model, for me, like operating model is you scale and just everything. And if you put it into the operating model and show people that there's a forum to pitch things and that you do not, your expectation is not that this will be successful. Your expectation is that you will come back and tell us whether this is something we want to continue to invest in or not. I think your point would be that it's how people see who do people visibly see progressing in their careers. And if they see people who are like, oh, they're steady state and they're just like steadily increasing their career within a company, that sets the tone for everyone else of how they get promoted within that company. If they see someone and they're like, oh, that person did this thing that failed, flamed out, but they actually went on and pivoted and did something else that became successful and they're doing really well in their career. I think that it's like how you set that tone within your culture. I'll tell you, in a scaling company, you need both and you should reward both. Because you can actually be biased in either way, because you need people who can just take programs and their job is just to continue to make that program successful. And you don't need them to continually innovate on things. Like you actually don't need that. It's a waste of time. It works great. They just need to keep it going. And they should be rewarded for the same people who kind of get all the limelight because they've tried to figure out something new. I think if you reward either one, if you reward over-index in either one, it's actually bad for the culture. But trying to find that balance is really hard. Because in large companies, you actually need both, and you don't need everyone to be kind of experimenting and innovative. Sometimes you just need people to do their job.
So with that, is there a mistake that you've made or a failure you've had that you're very proud of in terms of how that has helped your organization?
I remember within my first 6 to 12 months in HubSpot, I was like, oh, I'm going to build out this amazing tool. Like I was like, I'm going to grow through tools before we even had freemium. And the reason I wanted, it's like all wrong. Everything about this is wrong. The reason I wanted to build a tool is because I got fascinated by SimilarWeb's API. And I was like pulling in all the data. I was like, oh, look at all the data. And so I built this kind of like website. It was like a version of the website grader, but it graded blogs. So I was like, I'm going to build blog leaderboards in each country where HubSpot has like an office. And I didn't put anything in around how it would grow. I didn't put anything in around how it would create business or demand for HubSpot. And we spent real money. Like I spent real money of my budget building this amazing tool. And I had like, you would go there, you could get badge in, it would update every kind of day, pull in Moz data, SimilarWeb data. And we went and we did outreach to all the people and put badges on their websites. And then someone was like, okay, well, what's the how do we build recurring traffic to this? And I was like, and what business, how do you convert this into things for HubSpot? I was like, oh yeah, that's a good point. And so like I was like, I was like, okay, well, the one thing I have to try and stop, the one thing I have to like be diligent about is I know I get carried away. Like I know I just like, I see something, I just want to do it. And actually working in growth, that's why I think all marketers should at least, even if you don't work in like a growth oriented function, you should learn the growth framework in the same way you learn marketing frameworks, because it does teach you to step through problems in a linear sequenced way. And it teaches you, the one thing I've learned from working very close, like my background was computer science, so as a software engineer, but I kind of lost that when I got into marketing. And I think when I started working with product and engineering more, I realized that they're just way better at articulating problems and obsessing over problems and never starting anything until they properly understand the problem. And I think that's the learning. Like if you think about that tool, I actually didn't have a problem I was solving. I just had like a cool thing I wanted to do. I had a solution in mind, but no problem to solve. I think that's been one of the bigger lessons that I've took from working in growth. And I think why I think working across disciplines and working with other teams is great for everyone, because you just learn the ways that they approach work.
Yeah, it's interesting how definitely in my experience, the best way to learn is to make a mistake. It somehow just like opens your mind up to be so much more receptive and like, oh crap, how do I put things in order so that the next time I'm not making the same mistakes over and over. And it's funny. I mean, that's the most of my time these days is spent on Go Practice, kind of a simulator program for learning growth. And the whole idea is that people are constantly making mistakes as they navigate through trying to grow a business, and they get real-time feedback on those mistakes. But
oh, that's cool.
Yeah, but it is interesting, yeah, to kind of see that learning growth has always been really hard, and I was really challenged with it. I was challenged with figuring out how to help people learn it, but I wish I had kind of thought of this simulator approach, but it's actually my partner on the program who thought of this approach, but I got really excited when I saw it. So I definitely think that there's something there. So obviously we could go on and ask a ton more questions. We're going to schedule a whole separate NLP. But one question we really like to end on is, what do you feel like you understand about growth today that you may not have understood a couple of years ago?
I think obsessed over problem, team design matters more than you think. I think growth is frameworks, right? It just has great frameworks you can use to understand how the business grows and understand what your key levers are in that. And I think that's the thing that growth brings to the discipline it brings, is like teaching you how the business grows and then teaches you how to isolate the problems within that business model that you should solve and focus on. And it brings that discipline. You know, when I got into it, I just thought it sounded cool. I knew your work, I knew others' work, and I was like, oh, this is cool. I'm going to go and do growth. And when you go in there, like it's, I talked to someone recently and I was like, instead of doing an MBA, go learn growth. Like you're learning how modern businesses grow. And that I think it teaches you how to really assess how business grows and how you can impact that.
Yeah. I mean, the good news is that I think MBA programs are moving more toward teaching this way. I actually just spoke in Mark Roberge's Harvard Business School
course.
I know you've worked with Mark.
Yeah,
that's
awesome.
Exactly how he teaches it. He teaches it in a simulator type way. And then I actually just spoke in INSEAD. They're one of their MBA classes Monday of this week. And same thing. I essentially took the team through a what would you do 3-step process based on a set of challenges I had at LogMeIn. And it was cool. The professor at the end was like, that's the best guest lecture we've ever had. It's just, you know, this stuff is kind of boring if you're just sort of like one way teaching it. But yeah, it is a creative problem solving approach that as you come up across those problems and try to come up with solutions, and then being able to, you know, the one that I shared with them was kind of a thing at LogMeIn where we couldn't scale beyond $10,000 a month in profitable spending, and I was being told by the CEO to spend $100,000 a month and I could not find the channels, but here's what we did. I took them through these 3 steps. And by the way, at the end of this, within 3 months, I was able to spend $1 million a month with a 3-month payback on marketing dollars. What would you do? And so it's just really like, you just see people just get super engaged.
Yeah, the case study, I think it's a modern approach to business. Again, I advocate for maybe not all of it is applicable, but to your point, what you said is like it's a way to approach problems. I think all people in any kind of function will benefit from going some going through some version of it, because it does teach you the sequences of how to work through problems. And I think that's important for everyone who's building businesses.
Yeah. And that's part of the reason why Ethan and I have started asking more about how do you create an environment that is conducive to creative problem solving and risk taking, and some of those things where I've seen enough environments where it's really easy to shut down that creativity, stay inside the box. And that's where I think the stagnation happens.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I think you've done a great job, Kieran, today of like really surfacing some of the key things you can do, like to make that actionable. Like, how do you overcome these things? How do you work as a team? Talk to people who are better than you. Like, great piece of advice. It's one, especially when earlier in our careers, it's always, you know, there's always this fear, like people know that we don't know everything. People already know you don't know everything.
But your ability to figure stuff out.
Yeah.
So for me, that was like a really great key takeaway. And, you know, I think just sharing with us this thought about how over time, you know, you have to make big bets at scale. You have no other choice. But how do you deal with that? How do you create a culture where you can make mistakes? I'm a big believer of, you know, when you make a mistake, stand up on the table and yell at the top of your lungs. Because the key is when everyone knows that it's okay to make mistakes, that's how people learn how to make mistakes once instead of making the same one over and over again. So
exactly. Yeah.
Really great stuff. I really appreciate you taking the time to share all your insights with our audience today.
I'm going to go set up my profile at network.hubspot.com.
Let's go.
Kieran, thank you so much for sharing that HubSpot story. It's been something that I've viewed for a long time, but it's really the most in-depth look that I've had. Someone who's been along that journey for a long time. I know it may be sometimes embarrassing to spend so much time, but I know it takes a really dynamic person to be able to navigate for that long with a team that's probably morphed through many generations as you've gone through it. And the beauty of having you there so long is that you can really help share the twists and turns of that journey.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you so much for everything. And for those listening in, thanks for tuning in, and we'll get another episode out soon.
Thanks, Kieran.
Thanks for listening to the Breakout Growth Podcast. Please take a moment to leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. And while you're at it, subscribe so you never miss a show. Until next week.